You're listening to James Breslow on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome, everyone, to the James Breslow program, coming at you on a Tuesday afternoon. It's noon here in Los Angeles, California, and we've got some great guests lined up for you as usual today. In our first hour, coming up very soon, we've got Dr. Zudi Jasser. He's a senior fellow for the Center of Security Policy. You've seen him all over cable news commenting on various Islamic issues. He wrote a very interesting piece not too long ago in Newsweek where he draws the connection between the leftist BLM anti-fascist Antifa movement, I should say, in the United States and its connection with the radical Islamic movement. Why are those two groups connected? He explains why. We'll dig into that and get an update on the threat level currently in America of Islamic terror. It's not something we talk very much about. It's been pushed to the side. But with the open borders we've had for a couple of years, something tells me that something could be brewing. I pray not. But Dr. Zudi Jasser will be on in just a moment to discuss all that with us. First, my take on the news. Everyone is going apoplectic over this Dobbs decision overturning Roe v. Wade. We're hearing about calls to impeach the justices for lying under oath when they were first being confirmed. A couple of the justices were asked about Roe v. Wade, and they referred to it as settled precedent or precedent that certainly deserves respect, etc. None of them are on record as saying that they would or would not overturn Roe v. Wade. Most of them will never comment specifically on the facts of a case. And that's why there's absolutely zero chance of them proving that there was any lying under oath, because the facts of every case is unique and different. And until you dig into it, there's no way of telling how you would rule. But upon digging into the facts of this case, the one coming out of Mississippi, the court dug back into prior Supreme Court precedent to determine whether or not this law, which prohibited abortion after 15 weeks, should stand or not. And in digging into that precedent, the court ultimately concluded that there is no rational basis to continue to follow that Roe v. Wade precedent. Even the Casey case did not follow the Roe v. Wade precedent. So, but anyway, look for the left to continue going down that road. And then, of course, you've got the court packing idea. Simply add two more justices and turn it, flip it back the other way. That, of course, is a very slippery slope as one party gains power over the other and keeps adding justices to flip things back and forth. Fortunately, the word out of the White House is that President Biden does not support adding justices to the Supreme Court. So we can hope that that stays at bay. Then I did a little bit of digging into these groups that are out there protesting. You saw them at the Capitol in Arizona, almost breaking into the Capitol. They would have broken into the Capitol if they were able to, as happened at our U.S. Capitol not too long ago. But I love looking at the signs that the people hold. You got to kind of pause it sometimes and read the fine print at the bottom of the sign, because you see all these signs that people are holding that are all in the same color and the same font. And then you'll see a website at the bottom. That's where I was led during some of the Black Lives Matter protests to see some of these radical, radical Marxist groups that function in America. You go on the website and it's just crazy stuff. You almost think that the website is not real, but it absolutely is real. So I found such a website this time, and unfortunately I don't have the name of it for you. Maybe I'll get it for you in the next hour, but I can read for you a little bit what some of these websites say. These are these far left pro-choice website. Abortion on demand and without apology is the headline of the website. And not shockingly, the groups behind this radical pro-choice movement, this movement that wants abortion right up until the day of delivery, is the same far leftists you see in the Antifa movement and the Black Lives Matter movement and the Occupy Wall Street movement. They're all the same people. It says the attack on abortion rights is part of a patriarchal Christian fascist program. They love calling things fascist, and takes aim at contraception as well as LGBTQ rights. Denying the right to abortion hits poor women, and especially Black and other women of color, with vicious consequence. So they've roped in white supremacy, oppression of Black people. Actually, there's more percentage-wise Black abortions than white abortions. So by reducing abortion, you would actually increase the Black community. They don't seem to understand that part. And it tightens the chains of both white supremacy and the subjugation of women. Denying the right to abortion forces women to bear children against their will. Well, I think we all know how you get pregnant, and so it's hard to say that it's against their will, other than in the case of rape or incest, which I believe absolutely needs to be an exception in all states. And I know that there's a number of states right now, Arkansas included, that do not have that exception. There is no defense, in my opinion, for not having that exception. And Republicans are going to get hammered if they don't stop skirting that issue and address it head on and announce that they are that it should be one of the exceptions permitting abortion. Just jumping to the end, it's interesting to see who's part of this group. Sansara Taylor, the co-host of Revolution Nothing Less show. She's the co-initiator of RefuseFascism.org. You also have Sam Goldman, editorial board member of RefuseFascism.org. You have Merle Hoffman, founder and CEO of Choices Women's Medical Center, and author of Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of a Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. So you can see the radicals that are part of this group. And as I've said before, the party that claims the moderate middle is going to win on this issue. Neither side has claimed it yet. The Republicans still seem to be looking for abortion bans without exception, whereas the left is pushing for abortion on demand right up until the date of delivery, or at minimum for the first 6 months, right up until the date of viability. Both sides have extreme positions. Republicans, in my view, need to take a moderate view, allowing very restrictive abortion rights within a very limited period of time, also with exceptions, if they're going to ultimately win this issue. That's my take on the news, TNT Radio.
Opinions fact checked.
If we don't speak up now, nothing's going to change.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And we have Dr. Zudi Jasser with us, senior fellow for the Center for Security Policy, founder and president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. He's also a former U.S. Navy lieutenant commander and former vice chair of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, author of the book, A Battle for the Soul of Islam, An American Patriot's Fight to Save His Faith. Zudi, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. When I looked you up, and I didn't recognize your name right away, but then when I saw your face, of course I recognize your face. That you're very regularly on Fox News and a bunch of other networks.
Well, thank you. Yes, there's a lot been going on, and intermittently we continue to only pay attention to Islamic issues when they commit acts of terror. But we're seeing also, by the way, my day job is as a physician. I have a primary care practice, so I also have commented on COVID-related pandemic responses and other things that have also tested our democracy in many ways. So there's been a confluence of issues going on that the left has exploited when it comes to finding reasons to have government take over our lives.
Yeah, and you're located in Arizona, correct?
In Phoenix, Arizona. I grew up in Wisconsin originally. My family's from Syria. My parents escaped Syria in the mid-60s, escaping the Ba'athists, and came to the U.S. Legally waiting for political asylum when they got that from their congressman in Ohio. Then my dad ultimately moved to Wisconsin and started his practice where I was born and grew up. And then I served in the Navy 11 years on a Navy scholarship through medical school at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And now I've been living in Phoenix since 1999, practicing primary care, and also started a foundation called the American Islamic Forum for Democracy that many of us patriotic American Muslims who believe that terrorism is just a symptom and that the ultimate disease or diagnosis that needs to be treated is theocratic interpretations of Islam or political Islam, if you will, and the concept of the Islamic State, which we founded in 2003, the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. And that's basically the platform that we've been using to build coalitions against radical Islam. And now that's grown into a Western coalition called the Muslim Reform Movement that includes similar startup groups that are in Canada and Europe, Denmark, and the UK and across the United States of folks that are doing similar work against some of the establishment in our community that are the primary problem.
Yeah. So as we both said, things have been a little quiet on the radical Islamic front, not on the front page for quite some time, although you did have these guys on the terror watch list. And I'm curious if you followed that story. Of course, our border is a disaster. You know, you mentioned the political asylum. It's a joke. They're allowing Central Americans to come across, claim political asylum, and then release into the country. I just read today that the official number, according to one of the immigration judges who was talking about how inundated the courts are, and there's just no way to get to these cases, he said over 1.5 million pending cases. And I presume that a case, like if you're a family, it's probably one case. So we're probably talking about way more than 1.5 million people. But that's how many, at a minimum, have been allowed into this country from Central America to then wait for these hearings, which could take years. And in the meantime, they're released into America. It's just a crazy scenario, which we can talk about more if you'd like. But specifically, there's also been this news about these, I don't know, I forget how many it was, 25 or so or more that we are known to have crossed into America that are on the terror watch list, and Homeland Security doesn't seem to know where they are.
Yeah, it's beyond frightening. And I've testified to Congress back in 2018. And then before that, we had a series of hearings in 2011 and 2013 that Congressman Peter King had many of us in the reform movement testify to, that when it comes to immigration, you know, we need to have ideological filters. In the Cold War, we still have vestiges of that in immigration paperwork, in which we ask people, have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? Do you believe in communist ideology? And that was not a wasted question. You know, there are ways to vet whether people are coming, and especially America. You know, my family came to America because America was not about just coming for economic issues. It was about coming to an idea, an idea that was about a dream, a city on a hill, that they could practice their faith more freely here than they could in any so-called Muslim countries. And my parents basically understood that this democracy was the best place on the planet to live. And they escaped the oppression of Syria's regime and Middle Eastern regimes. But, you know, we should have an ideological vetting. And I've been, you know, many of us have been dealing with this since 9/11. If you look in Europe, there were millions of refugees that escaped Syria as a result of that civil war. And Europe right now is dealing with a huge terror threat because they had no ideological vetting. And some of the studies showed that literally one out of five folks that left Syria were somewhat sympathetic to ISIS, that were some, and one out of 10 felt that terrorism was a means that they could use. Now, that then tells you that 90% condemned terrorism, 80% had nothing to do with ISIS and were actually probably more like my family. But that is a huge number. If you talk about 10% of 1 million or 25% of a million, you're talking about a significant terror threat that the Europeans just sort of let into their borders out of their kindness. And that's why Europe right now, if you look at what's happening in France, you have liberals like Macron actually talking about French identity and that if you're going to come to France, you have to believe in the national ideology of secularism, of laïcité policies. You have Austria that has now outlawed political Islam as an ideology. Now, I think that's the wrong treatment for the right disease. But again, they're doing things that are in many ways beyond what a democracy would do, but it's because they're confronted with such threats. Austria had its first terror attack last October, in which a Catholic, an Orthodox priest, was killed and slaughtered by an ISIS recruit on the streets of Austria. And the, you know, Sebastian Kurz responded with that quick change in law, which was really not a democratic thing to do. But on the other hand, they have not been treating the disease. So as a result, you see a lot of this dysfunctional response, and America's headed there. And we've been testifying to this to Congress and elsewhere. And meanwhile, we're just sort of letting people flood through our borders, including sympathizers of ISIS, Hezbollah, and the Taliban, as you saw with what happened in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Do you have any guesstimate as to how many extremist Muslims have come across our southern border in the past year and a half?
Well, that's nobody knows, because the data, all we know is that we have had tens of thousands moving across weekly. And if you do the math, even though we assume that they're all from either Central America or South or Mexico or elsewhere, a 5 to 10% of them are from Europe and also the Middle East. So if you do the math, we're talking about tens of thousands of the million that are probably from the Middle East, that are finding ways in which to come here because of radicalization. And it's interesting, in Europe itself, for example, where you'd think they'd be sharing information, there were folks that were released that then committed second and third acts of terror because they were released from prisons and went to other countries. So to say that somehow we're able to vet them at our border is, I think, foolhardy. And it's only a matter of time until part of the reason why we haven't seen as many attacks is we completely decimated their command and control with ISIS in Syria. But they're rebuilding. There's Al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula. There's other, whatever the branding is of radical Islam of the day is going to continue to push the ideologies across the globe. And it's only a matter of time until there are other attacks.
Gotcha. Okay, well, we're up against a break. We'll be back with Dr. Zudi Jasser on TNT Radio.
Michael Parker on TNT Radio.
In London, traces of the polio virus have been found during a routine sewage inspection in London. This is according to the UK Health Security Agency, and they're considering declaring a national incident. Says officials believe that there has been some spread between closely linked individuals in northeast London, probably extended family members, of the virus that's now being found in the sewers. So what this is they do periodic checks of sewers, and especially all over the U.S. and I'm guessing all over the world. Several closely related polio viruses were found in sewage samples taken between February and May. It has continued to evolve, and this is where it gets interesting, people, has now been classified as a vaccine-derived polio virus type 2. That's right.
Deprogram with Michael Parker on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that. mainstream media censors, smears, and intimidates those telling the truth.
We mandate that the truth be told.
Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And we are back on the James Breslow Show talking to Dr. Zudi Jasser, Senior Fellow at the Center for Security Policy, and the current state of the Islamic threat in the U.S. You mentioned, go into a little bit more detail as far as why we haven't seen as much activity of late. You say basically it was disrupted in Syria. How quickly are they reconstituting, and when do you expect that that threat could rear its head again?
So there's a couple things going on here. First of all, I think, you know, people don't realize that 9/11 was created a huge internecine battle between the very militants like Al Qaeda, and then obviously in 2013 the ISISs of the world, versus those who want to do things peacefully, such as or more peacefully, if you will, and didn't like the fact that Al Qaeda outed the fact that they were trying to create Islamic supremacist states wherever they could. And thus terrorism was about getting American bases out of the Middle East. It was about taking away Western influence so that, as we saw in the Arab Awakening, the Islamic movements could fill that gap. So there's always been this battle about whether it's a civilizational jihad or whether it's a militant jihad. So part of it, they've been sort of regrouping now. They realize the ISISs and Al-Qaedas of the world are not winning recruits. They're actually alienating Muslim populations. So the Muslim Brotherhood, Islamic groups in the West, et cetera, have begun to sort of take that over. And we saw the ascendancy of sort of civilizational jihadis that are more Islamist sympathizers, like the Ilhan Omars of the world and others that sort of normalized a political Islam and being supposedly anti-terror and otherwise. So that's part of the strategic shift that they've had. Militant-wise, they have to have folks driving their military agenda. And when their command and control in northern Iraq, and then which became Syria, it took, by the way, the U.S. and President Trump to decimate that, and General Mattis, as the Secretary of Defense, to finally do that. Within 6 months, it was done. Folks thought that Assad was actually fighting ISIS or Russia was fighting ISIS, and they weren't. They were actually allowing ISIS to thrive while they decimated and committed a genocide in Syria of the general population. So ultimately, we see that the defeats that they had in Syria set them back a lot. But they've also popped up almost like a whack-a-mole, where you see them pop up in Somalia. You see them popping up in northern Africa. And also now in Afghanistan, they're going to reconstitute. Probably this is why I don't think we're headed to more peaceful times. Our withdrawal from Afghanistan was so dysfunctional. Listen, I also came around to saying that we had really no business being there anymore. We proved that we could not, we didn't have enough of a functional response in Afghanistan to bring them into a civil democracy, if you will. But having said that, there's a way to withdraw in which you hand over the perception that it's going to be run by Afghanis and will fail because of the Afghanis, versus a perception that America made it fail. And the way President Biden's administration withdrew from there totally handed the victory to the Islamists, the Taliban. And now we've seen them become basically what they were on 9/10/01, which is a haven for radical Islam, for terrorism, for Sharia states, if you will. And they're going to reconstitute and continue to befriend the radical elements in Pakistan, as they have across the border and also into Iran.
Mm-hmm. Has that Afghanistan debacle in any way changed their view about America? America pulled out. We handed it over to the radical Muslim Taliban. Do they still hate America after that? Are we enemy number one still?
The bottom line is the Islamists, the theocrats, if you will, those who are running, who want to run Islamic republics or the ascendant caliphate, if you will, those folks will never like America. They see secular liberal democracy in the West as the greatest existential threat to their ascendancy. But they're a minority. If you saw in the elections across the Middle East after the Arab Awakening of 2011, from every country, from Tunisia to Egypt and Yemen and Libya and others, while each of them were significantly dysfunctional, there was an initial appeal to be democratic, to for freedom and for liberty. And we see, you know, whether it was our attempt, our failed attempts at television stations in Iraq, like Al Hurra, which means freedom and liberty. Those failed attempts where we didn't understand and we didn't really do like we did in the Cold War, which is to create a movement like Radio Free Europe and others to really start creating a grassroots movement that understood that it wasn't about American imperialism and it wasn't about Western invasions, but rather about liberty and about liberating those populations and allowing them to have some independence. But that we completely didn't put the right resources in. We thought there were going to be military solutions. It wasn't for us to take over Iraq. It was to allow them to fail on their own. And just like the West had multiple revolutions through the Enlightenment, French had 9, I think. I don't know how many in the West until democracy finally settled in. Middle East is going to be the same. And we don't need to have troops there while they're going through that revolution after revolution. But we do need to, you know, be the strong horse, if you will, as far as the ideas go. And our ideas of freedom were decimated by Arab media. Al Jazeera did nothing to promote and the truth through the Middle East, but rather continued to portray us as the evil ones, to portray Israel as conspiracy theory number whatever that they continue to focus on. Through their anti-Semitism and otherwise, and there were no competitors to the Al Jazeeras of the Arab Middle East or the press TV of Iranian TV or the Pakistani TV that constantly demonized the West and blamed us for all of their ills instead of blaming the reality, the truth, which is their theocrats, their dictators that were so corrupt and evil.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your Newsweek piece. First of all, a question about Newsweek, who owns Newsweek these days? It seems like I'm seeing more conservative things coming out of that magazine. What do you know about Newsweek?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I don't remember exactly how the ownership changed, but I do know that their editorial division has gone through some very positive changes towards a more diverse mindset. While they still have folks left of center writing for them, they now have had a significant outreach to having more conservative writers because, again, I think it came from ownership that have said basically this is not going to be just an arm of MSNBC and an arm of the far left Democratic political machine. So I think that it has sort of left those roots and now is beginning to sort of navigate a little bit both left and right of center.
Yeah, and we're hearing there could be changes coming at CNN in the same regard, which could be very interesting.
Yes, absolutely. And
Zucker is gone and it's under some new leadership. And I mean, there's definitely an opportunity for somebody to carve out the middle, it seems to me, because everything is pretty far left. And then there's Fox News and then further right of Fox News and not much in between. I definitely miss the most trusted name in news, CNN, which it arguably once was, but certainly hasn't been for a long time.
Yeah, there was a time I remember back when the Ground Zero Mosque was attempting to be built. I was on CNN frequently, as I was on MSNBC with Joe Scarborough. But then after during the Trump era, the left dug their heels so far in that if any way you were perceived, and I can tell you personally, if you're perceived as somehow a conservative, you were not welcome there unless you towed the line when it came to their anti-Republican, anti-conservative, and anti-Trump at the time agenda. And I can tell you as a Muslim, our reform movement is very diverse. It includes folks that believe in gay rights, women's rights, and so many issues that we might disagree when it comes to the abortion issue. We might disagree on certain family values issues. And yet we could not, any of us, get any time on CNN or MSNBC. And then you wonder why the Islamists at the Islamic Society of North America, the Council on American Islamic Relations, why they dominate the narrative when it comes to American perceptions about Islam. And it's because we really don't have any equal time. We don't want to put their voices out, But the Ilhan Omars of the world end up being the only voices for Islam when it comes to that media, CNN and MSNBC mm-hmm. and others.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in the article, you talked about the red-green axis. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so, you know, this is also something that we've been talking about. My family understood in Syria, which is, you know, for a long time in the Middle East and then at the UN, you saw tyrants who are socialists that ultimately rise through a somewhat nationalist at times, but also can be far left, as we see in Venezuela, as we see in various countries in which whether it's Maduro or whether it's the Islamist across the Middle East, Jamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt was all about socialism. They came to power by saying that ultimately they were the voice of the people, et cetera. And when we saw the Black Lives Matter movement a couple years ago start a lot of its demonstrations through the cities and its violence and its destruction of our institutions and our statues and others, I was saying, listen, this is what we were saying was happening across the Middle East, was that ultimately you have this far left union with the Islamists, the far left being the red and the green being the Islamists. You see in the UN, for example, Venezuela and Iran vote together almost every time. That's why a small little country, a democratic country, the only democracy in the Middle East, pretty much Israel, is the focus of over 50% of the time in the UN, because the red-green axis votes together. The Chinas of the world vote with the Turkeys and the Irans of the world, the Islamist movements, the Muslim Brotherhood types of sympathizers. And that axis has existed for a long time. They believe in collectivism. They believe in a controlled economy. You see the code pinks going to Tehran and ignoring how anti-women the Iranian regime is, because they are at the thing that brings them together are two things: their anti-Americanism and their anti-Semitism. And the same thing happened with BLM. You saw that some of their leadership were deeply tied into the Louis Farrakhan Nation of Islam movement and how anti-Semitic they were. Farrakhan was notorious not only for talking about the Jewish community in horrific ways, like calling them termites and otherwise, he also was very cozy with tyrants like Gaddafi and others, who he famously called a great man. So, you know, this is interesting. We saw when they started to tear down statues of our founding fathers and folks that really, I think, were legends in American history and our freedom and independence and our Constitution. The Islamists and the Taliban did the same thing with statues of Buddha, with what you see the Saudis do, for example, with any types of history in the Arabian Peninsula. They want to erase history, rewrite it, and pretend that they are the beginning of history, and as if none of the foundational values. And that's why some of our Muslim reform is about saying, you know what, we want to go back to what exactly was what we think is a more modern interpretation of what the Prophet Muhammad wanted, rather than the revisionist stuff of what the Wahhabis of Saudi Arabia or the Khomeinists of Iran want. So you see sort of this confluence of the same types of behaviors and methodology of misinformation that the far left does and the Islamist theocrats do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me read quickly from your article. You say, why do 21st century progressives, chiefly consumed with human rights and social justice, find common cause with a religiously doctrinaire subset of Muslims who, far from practicing social justice and adhering to human rights, ultimately seek to live in a society governed by Sharia Islamic jurisprudence? Understanding the connection between these two seemingly opposed political movements is a matter of identifying their priorities. On its surface, far-left atheism and Islamic religious fanaticism appear to be at odds, but beneath the veneers of woke rhetoric and political posturing, their compatibility stands out. Tell us about their, instead of me keep reading, tell us about how they're compatible. I mean, both basically in their hatred of America.
Yeah, I mean, let me give you a couple examples. One is, look at the suppression of free speech. We see ultimately now the far left is using what tactic? They're trying to suppress free speech. We saw it through the pandemic. We saw it through any criticism of what some of us have. We haven't even been able to get a platform for Muslim reform because I am listed by the Council on American Islamic Relations as an Islamophobe, even though I'm a medical ethicist who loves my faith and believes ultimately that in the orthodox practice of my faith. And yet that doesn't matter to them just because I'm critical of Islamic leadership and Islamic institutions that exist today that need reform, no different than pre-Enlightenment to Europe and Christendom needed reform at the time. That's where I feel Islam is today. And I think it's interesting that they label that as Islamophobia. The Ilhan Omars of the world tried to have a legislation passed to create at the State Department a perch for a identified position in which somebody would be sort of the ambassador against Islamophobia, who I could see no other role for other than basically suppressing any criticism of Islam like the Organization of Islamic Cooperation tries to do. So we see them using some of the same techniques. We see them also trafficking in severe anti-Semitism and spreading conspiracy theories about Israel and otherwise, working hand in hand with large anti-Semitic movements like the BDS movement, which is the Boycott and Divestment and Sanctions movement that really wants to see the economic destruction of Israel. And you'll see that the BLM movement never distances itself from the Islamists that and the BDS folks that do that. So, you know, I think it's interesting that nobody calls them out on that hypocrisy. And I can't, you know, for example, I work closely with Ezra Noumani, who's a former Wall Street Journal reporter and a liberal activist. And it's amazing how none of that media will put her on because she's been basically boycotted by the Islamists. And you'll find they don't want to hear the voices of true feminism, of true civil liberty thought. They just want to have those that toe the line and push their agenda, regardless of how hypocritical it might be about what happens behind the doors of their mosque, where women are relegated to the back, to the other rooms where they're not on any boards, et cetera. We tried to get the Obama administration to recognize that a lot of the mosques are hypocritical when it comes to their support for the far left in the way they deal with things internally. And they would not give us the time of day.
By the way, I have to ask, since it's the topic du jour, what does Sharia law say about abortion?
So that's fascinating. I've actually studied that very extensively in my studies as a medical ethicist. And, you know, I will tell you that I personally believe that life starts at conception. And to me, it's a slippery slope argument to somehow say that life would be defined somehow by viability. So to me, that then you go to the Islamic interpretation of, you know, those who protect a life, it's like they protected all mankind. That those who have killed a life, it's like they've killed all mankind. And we see that in the Judeo-Christian tradition also. But then you look at the reality of Islamic interpretations, and they will give you certain passages that tell you that life starts at the heartbeat, which would be 6 weeks plus. And so there's really no consensus. It's not as black and white as it might be, for example, for the Catholic tradition or it's probably more similar to some of the variable interpretations that you see across differing Jewish traditions, from the Orthodox to the more Reform and liberal tradition. But again, I think the reality is going to come to I think it's absurd. When I read a tweet from Barbara Streisand or some yesterday that's called our Supreme Court justices, which are the most sophisticated in the planet, compared them to the Taliban, it sort of tells you how absurd the language is and how ridiculous. You have the Taliban, which literally endorses female genital mutilation, which literally prevents women from having any vote in Sharia courts and Islamic jurisprudence, or having any rights whatsoever unless their husbands or their fathers or their brothers give them those rights. That is something that's being compared to a court that finally recognized that abortion is not mentioned in the Constitution, that it basically belongs to each state and the people to decide on their own.
Yeah. So what would be the law in Afghanistan under the Taliban, or the law in Iran under the Ayatollah on abortion?
So how about what's the law for a daughter who, for example, might be found to be pregnant And she's not married. She's killed. In Saudi Arabia, rape victims don't have rights. They actually become criminals because they become a dishonor to their family. And if you look, the UN has posted statistics of honor killings that exist around the world. And not only do we have hundreds that exist in the West, but tens of thousands globally, where a brother will kill his sister because she's dishonored the family. And we've seen it from Dallas to Phoenix to across the West, where we have incidents in which a father might, you know, here in Phoenix, we had a Iraqi father that drove over his daughter because she decided she wasn't going to wear a hijab and she was going to date, and was embarrassing the family because she drank alcohol. So, you know, I don't think that at the end of the day, they really are in Sharia law, the way they practice it and interpret it in its 12th century variety, cares about the life of the unborn. You know, to them, it's about honor and a draconian medieval interpretation that needs reform. It needs to be. And I think the majority of Muslims reject that. The problem is that we're not having that debate. Or, you know, as much as I've tried to debate imams across the country, you know, when they find that they lose those debates, they run away from the platform, because I would at any time welcome a debate with leading clerics about what they recognize as the rights of the unborn and how their interpretation and how it gets meted out where Muslims are a majority versus, I mean, what American Muslims do here, I don't think counts, because this is about a majority Judeo-Christian population that has a liberal democracy in which they live. That's not fair. What would a majority Muslim population, what do, you know, I can tell you where I've navigated some debates within Muslim communities and families that are dealing with these things. And, you know, the last person often we want to turn to is the imam to tell us really what to do, because they're so unschooled when it comes to other areas of life beyond Quranic interpretation, such as medical science, philosophy, and other areas of life and existentialism and things that relate to how you come to a decision in the modern day, that they're still really using 13th century constructs.
Hmm. All right, we got to take a break. When we return from the break, we know what the left wants of America. It wants it to turn it into socialist, communist country. What does the fundamental Islamic movement want for the future of America? We'll cover that when we get back from the break. You're listening to the James Breslow Show on TNT Radio.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
More than 1 million voters across 43 U.S. states have switched to the Republican Party over the last year, according to voter registration data analyzed by the Associated Press. ABC 30 Action News stated that nowhere is the shift more pronounced and dangerous for Democrats than in the suburbs, where well-educated swing voters who turned against Trump's Republican Party in recent years appear to be swinging back. Liberal elites who class themselves as well-educated are now wringing their hands in despair that so many university-educated voters would be joining the deplorables. How could they? But perhaps it is they who lack a proper education and real-world experience. It is this state of affairs which will ensure the midterm election results will somewhat reflect natural law, as opposed to the system of arbitrary rules imposed on the masses by the liberal elites. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
For the news and talk you can't hear anywhere else, it's TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the James Breslow Show. We're in our final segment with Dr. Zudi Jasser, Senior Fellow for the Center of Security Policy and author of the book, A Battle for the Soul of Islam, An American Patriot's Fight to Save His Faith. We're talking about this unholy alliance in America, which is a pretty disgusting alliance between the hard left and fundamental Islam, both sharing a hatred for America. I think we know what the left wants for the future of America, but what does Islam want for the future of America?
You know, I'm so glad you asked that, because often we never get to that point. We just sort of think they hate us. Ultimately, it's interesting now that as we enter what might be a cold war with China, we see what's happening with Russia. You know, I sort of see a triangulation of the world, which is Western democracies on one point, China and Russia on another point, especially China. And the third point are Islamic regimes. 56 countries are dominated by Islamic Muslim majorities. And unless Islam can go through a modern reformation, and remember, Islam itself is 1,440 years old. So all of the major faiths went through major transformations pretty much at about their 15th to 17th centuries. And Islam is going to go through that. Now, the question is, will we survive that if they're working with the Chinas of the world and that two points of that triangle wants to destroy the other point? You know, I can tell you right now, if 56 Muslim majority countries, they want to see, number one, they want America to become isolationist, not only militarily, but rather ideologically. And actually, the military bases and otherwise, you know, I've always felt we should not have a base in Qatar. Turkey really shouldn't be a part of NATO because, you know, the Turks, as much as they are a democracy, Erdogan now has imprisoned more journalists than any country on the planet. Qatar itself is basically sees itself as the center point for the global caliphate of the Muslim Brotherhood, if you will. And that's what Al Jazeera is doing. So to think that we have bases there and we see them as allies when ideologically they see Islamic republics and Islamic state. So what is Islamism? Political Islam is the ideology, just like communism, socialism, capitalism. It's an ism that believes that the state's legal system should be run by Islamic law, interpreted by clerics that then have an identity that they want to die for in their state national identity, which is Islam. So until you separate mosque and state and you separate the national identity from that, Islamic states view any non-Islamic state as a threat. At the time in the 7th, 8th century, they divided the world into the land of Islam and the land of war. So wherever there wasn't Islam dominating their governments, they wanted to basically be at conflict either militarily or industrially. So that's sort of where we're headed unless people start to get their head around what Islamic operatives and Islamic regimes and ideologues want to do when it comes to working with the West.
Mm-hmm. Well, how far would you say they want to extend the caliphate? For instance, would they like it to extend through Europe?
You know, that's actually sometimes I feel like we lose so much conversation about our, you know, this sort of not conspiracy theory, but in some ways to say that in America where Muslims are 1% or in France where they're even 11% that they want to take over France. That's I wish the West Europeans wouldn't waste that much time on that conversation. Now, are they a threat? Yeah, do they live in enclaves? Absolutely. They'd rather see Sharia law in many of their neighborhoods rather than French law. They'd rather see it in Belgium and elsewhere. But their interactions with the West is to try to weaken them so that they turn inward and they're not influencing their countries, be it Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Iran, Turkey, etc. So it's all about weakening the influence upon Muslim majority countries than it is actually about taking those countries over. Now, as they weaken them later in the long-term war, which they're very patient with, as we saw in Afghanistan, they waited 20 years to see us leave and they prop right back up and are running that country. So yes, in the long term, they want to see a caliphate, and the caliphate exists today. It's called the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. 56 countries that left to their own devices hate one another, like Iran and Saudi Arabia, but together they vote as a bloc when it comes to a lot of things that are voted on in the UN.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you're arguing, they want Western interests out of the Middle East, out of Muslim majority countries. And it sounds like you're saying that we ought to go along with that, which would include, I mean, for instance, the fact that we pulled entirely out of Afghanistan, you of course disagree with how we did it. It was a debacle. However, you like the idea that we pulled out. I mean, what about also pulling out of that Bagram Air Force base that some people, if I have the name correct, that some people complain about, but it sounds like you're saying you think, no, it was a good thing that we left that base.
Well, actually, you know, I do think that the old doctrine, if you will, be it the Bush doctrine or whatever it might be, that somehow there's military solutions to these things. Anyone who's been, you know, a sentient human being paying attention realizes that that's not going to happen. But, you know, the Korean example, the German example, the fact that we have bases in places that have maintained peace is an important part to learn from in the last century. So I'm not saying that we should have pulled bases out completely, but we needed to maintain the safety. We didn't lose any soldiers in Afghanistan until the debacle for a number of years. So, you know, yes, was there a higher risk? Absolutely. But the solution, here's what I believe our doctrine should be for whatever, whoever's in the White House, be it, you know, a Republican in the next administration or whatever the party might be. The doctrine should be that we should be on the offense when it comes to liberty and the ideas of human rights, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and what are the values. This binary approach to allies, where we either love them or hate them, the Saudis, we embrace them, even though we share none of their values, you know, or we somehow call him a pariah, as Biden was doing, is absurd. You know, there needs to be a grading in which we tell them you're a D minus when it comes to human rights, but yet we're going to work with you because Iran invading you would be a disaster to not only your security, but to global security. So there is a doctrine in which we can say we are going to pump in radio and social media and others to change, to advance those who and protect those who share our values. And by doing that, we're going to help social movements that support our values while also not confronting your societies militarily, which is not our role to do, but only yours to protect.
Yeah, well, I see a real chicken and egg thing here, both when it comes to that policy and also the idea of us having bases there or not. The idea of having continuing to have a base in Afghanistan is to fight terrorism. Yet the terrorism seems to emanate from our presence in the Middle East. So, I mean, if we were, they really, you're pointing out that they really want us out of their sphere of influence. If we were to abide by that, would they leave us alone? Could we feel comfortable that the threat of terror becomes very minimal because we pulled out our bases out of the Middle East and we stopped trying to mess around with their governments or trying to convert somebody from being a Sharia law state versus a democracy?
I can't tell you enough how much I've tried, and maybe I'm not articulating this well, but I do think there's a difference between, you know, us giving them fruit in which to use in their propaganda, like Abu Ghraib and other things that happened there, that which obviously we not only shouldn't have done, but were un-American, versus saying that somehow there's anything we can do. It was almost as if I thought one of the best things the Trump administration did was to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Because for long they said, oh, all hell will break loose and terrorism will happen. Nothing happened. Because this linkage concept that somehow what America does will make terrorism go away, it's not about what America does. That's an excuse. Even if we pulled out completely, they'd start to focus on Kashmir. They'd focus on Israel. They'd do other things to somehow find something in a Machiavellian way to blame others so that they could unify their own people into believing in Islamic theocracy. So just like when we wanted in the Cold War, the Soviet Union had to implode on its own, and it's still hasn't necessarily corrected its ways in many ways. China, the same thing. The worst policy we had, it might have been short-lived economic success, but this open-door policy to somehow saying that if we had economic cooperation with them, it would modernize China and make them their communism melt away. It has not happened. And that's why, you know, you see the genocide happening against the Uyghurs and the huge human rights abuses happening in China. That ultimately, and the Wall Street Journal had a great piece 2 months ago on why we should enter a quasi-cold war with China. That might be the best policy to have. So all I can say is I've called for now the gas prices now, I was actually saying might be a blessing, not from the prices perspective. We should be pumping our own oil. And I didn't ever expect us to avoid Middle Eastern oil because somehow we'd also shut down our own oil. But that's what the Biden administration is. But I'd love to see our spigots turn back on, our prices come down, and tell the Saudis and others that we don't need their oil. And my grandfather used to say the best thing that could ever happen to the Saudis and the Saudi people was for America to tell them to drink their own oil, because then they'd have to do like Japan and start to have a more modern creative economy rather than one simply dependent on natural resources. So there's a lot of things we can do to help push reform in the 21st century method rather than sort of feeding the old habits of the 20th century.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, I really enjoy you joining the program. Just we hit the tip of the iceberg there, so I'd love to have you back on again sometime. Dr. Zudi Jasser, check out his book about A Battle for the Soul of Islam, an American Patriot's Fight to Save His Faith. And real quick, where can people find you on the internet?
Find me at AIF Democracy, AIF as in forumdemocracy.org, and find me on Twitter at Dr. Zudi Jasser, DrZudiJasser.
All right. Thanks again. We'll be back after the break with more of the James Breslow Show on TNT Radio.